Lesson 3 of our Galatians class, Galatians chapter 1, verses 10 through 24. So we're moving on into the real meat of Paul's argument, where he's trying to show that the teaching of the Judaizers was not accurate. And to do that, he first has to start by showing that his own teaching was different. Now, you might think that's a given, but the Judaizers were actually trying to take what they were saying, what Paul was saying, and lump all that in together as being the official word from Jerusalem. And so they were being kind of sneaky about it, really, in connecting everyone together and pretending that there was no conflict, but that we're all on the same team, we're all really preaching the same thing, Paul just didn't finish telling you what you needed to do. So we're going to be using a technique in this lesson that is called mirror reading. You may have heard of this before. Even if you haven't, you have probably used it without even realizing it. We've given it a name here, but it's really nothing more than what you do when you're listening to one side of a conversation. So I want you to imagine that I'm up here on the phone talking to someone, and you can't hear you can't hear what the other person is saying, but you can hear what I'm saying. How much of the other side of the conversation do you think you can infer just by what I'm saying? Probably a decent amount of it. There might be some details you don't know, some bits where you're a little bit confused, but overall, you should probably be able to tell roughly what the other person is saying just by how I respond to them. The reason that we need to do this is we know that Paul is responding to the Judaizers, but we don't have a text that tells us what the Judaizers were actually saying. We know in general the claims that Judaizers made, but really we have to look at it from the perspective of what Paul is saying to answer their argument to then infer what the argument is. Does that make sense? Do you got questions about that? I'm probably making it sound more complicated than necessary. It's really not all that complicated. It would be like if you heard me on the phone saying, no, I can't be there for Christmas because my kids are sick. You might infer that whoever I'm talking to on the other side of the phone call was asking if I was going to be with my family for Christmas, or whatever the case may be. That kind of mirror reading, mirror listening, where you're inferring what the other side is saying, that's basically what we're doing here. All right, so let's go ahead and go into verses 10 through 17. Galatians chapter 1, verses 10 through 17. For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please him, I would not be a servant of Christ. For I would have you know, brothers, that the gospel that was preached by me is not man's gospel, for I did not receive it from any man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. For you have heard of my former life in Judaism, how I persecuted the church of God violently and tried to destroy it, and I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my own age among my people. So extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers. But when he who had set me apart before I was born, and who called me by his grace, was pleased to reveal his son to me, in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not immediately consult with anyone, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went away into Arabia and returned again to Damascus. So Paul's first big point here is that his teaching does not have any human origin, and in particular, it does not originate from Jerusalem. So he starts out by saying he's not trying to please men. And this should be obvious if you read what Paul said and what he did on his preaching journeys. He did not go around trying to garner favor from people and to accumulate a large following. That is the tactic that many people have. They had back then, people do it today, where if you say the right things, you can get a lot of people to be very happy with you. But you have to be willing to reduce the message down to something that is so easy, so palatable, really so meaningless that there's nothing to object, nothing to be unhappy about. And of course, that is a tactic we see a lot of people using today in many churches, in many religious venues. The teaching that goes on is so surface level, so basic, that there's not a chance to really progress in any sort of spiritual maturity. And sadly, that can even happen in churches that claim to follow Jesus, in the churches of Christ. So we need to be careful that we're not continually reducing the message of God down to something that is going to be easier for people to stomach. Paul certainly didn't try to do that. He preached a message that demanded change. He did not hold back at all. It was a very challenging message, but it obviously had a great upside to it of restoring your relationship with God. He says that trying to please men, verse 10, says, am I still trying to please men? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ. That these two goals are incompatible. You can't be trying to do both. That is because serving Christ and pleasing men have very different strategies that get you there. So, a choice has to be made. Just like Jesus says, you cannot serve God and mammon. You cannot serve God and the things of the world or the people of the world. We understand that Paul knew this too. He was a servant of Christ, and if that meant that sometimes people were angry with him or angry with the message that he preached, he realized that it was not really about him. It was not that they were rejecting him. They were rejecting the message of Christ. And that makes it a little easier to bear, because while it may sound personal, it's not. It's really a rejection of God, and that's not my job to deal with or to handle. That's God's job. And he can be the judge of that. What thoughts do you have so far? So Paul is giving this message of sacrifice, something that's very difficult for them to hear and to really follow through with. But he's not unwilling to do that himself. We've got to remember Paul's history. That Paul was a Jewish success story. He spent much of his life trying to rise up in the ranks of the Pharisees. He, of course, had to play all the political games that are necessary to do so. And he says that his zeal for those distorted Jewish traditions was so great that we know that he eagerly imprisoned and killed Christians. We know that Paul was willing to do anything that it took to do what he thought was serving God, but was really serving self and serving these very twisted versions of Judaism that had become prominent. We got to remember that. In this whole book, we're not really addressing Judaism all by itself. That is a slightly too shallow understanding of what Paul's letter to the Galatians is really about. There are a lot of the same points you could make, that Judaism has been done away with, that the law of Moses is now complete, and so there's no need to observe it anymore. But Paul was really addressing them taking Judaism and twisting it to their own desires and making their own social and community structure out of it, that emphasized the things that they wanted to emphasize and ignored the things that they wanted to ignore. You look at much of what the Pharisees and the Sadducees and others, scribes, were doing in Jesus' day, and you compare that back to what we see in the law of Moses, and it's baffling. It's like we're not even looking at the same law. Like, you see some of the same elements there. There's still the temple, there are still sacrifices, but who are the Pharisees? Who are the Sadducees? Why are they, in many cases, the villains, the antagonists of the story, instead of being the righteous religious leaders that they were supposed to be? That's because there had been generations of focusing on traditions and the ideas of men instead of actually God's law. And that is the only thing that can result in. I am not sure off the top of my head. Yeah.
That was there, but it was not in the Mosaical laws that was even there. We had the priests, and they, like you already said, they just, far from the defensive makeup of the Mosaical law, these people had totally changed their laws and used the laws that were developed by them, basically.
Yeah. Right. There's, you know, of course, in any nation, there's room for them to establish, you know, the structure of law that they needed to. Like, you know, they already had God's law, which was supposed to be their religious and their civil law. And, you know, they can establish judges and you know, people to help teach the law and even kings and such, though God certainly advised them against that. But, yeah, the Sanhedrin had turned into a very weird thing there. I'm not exactly sure when that started, but they don't come across looking very good in the Bible. They are opposing Jesus, and they're really supporting the traditions of men instead of the law of God. Well, people are very good at coming up with titles and bureaucracies and hierarchies and all sorts of things to gratify our need for power and structure. And most of that is very unnecessary. Most of that is self-serving rather than actually an attempt to follow God's law. We see the same kind of thing today. The vast majority of these denominations have their councils or their hierarchies where you got to answer up the food chain, and they say what the doctrine is going to be for the year 2019 coming up. They decide year over year what the goals of the denomination are, how they're going to adjust with the times, and there's a way that you can kind of rise up through the ranks. And that is a very appealing kind of position for people. for ambitious people, which a lot of us are, to have a structure to climb up in. You know, people weren't any different back then. Extremely. And this is actually going to make Paul uniquely qualified to address this issue. Of course, he's inspired by God, so his personal background could be completely different, and he'd still be qualified. But there is an extra layer to this where he came out of all of this. And the Judaizing teachers, I mean, that would have been him, just with a slightly different path. Like, they were Christians, they believed in Christ, and they were just trying to add in their own ideas with it. If Paul had converted to Christianity but had been less dedicated to it, had wanted to try to have it both ways, that is exactly what he would have become. A Christian who wants to keep all the trappings of then modern day Judaism. But he had thrown that away. He had counted that as dung, as he says in Philippians, that he's not going to pursue Judaism anymore, even though it's something that gave him a lot of power and a lot of prestige and something that he had a lot of potential to grow even more in. He realized that there was a very toxic element to that, and it was no longer God's law, even in its purest form. So there's no point in continuing it. So as Paul's writing to a church of Gentiles, he is very uniquely qualified to tell them that Judaism is not the way to go. If anyone is going to want to promote it, it would be Paul. But he doesn't do that. I've seen preachers who come from different backgrounds kind of use their history to their advantage. I've known some preachers who came out of Catholicism or who came out of atheism or came out of all sorts of different things. And their background, their understanding of what it is like to live in that mode gives them, a different perspective on the law of God, on teaching the superiority of God's law over these man-made traditions. And so, yes, while it would be better to not have years of your life dedicated to serving something false, you can't go back and undo what has already been done. All you can do is use to your advantage what experience you have. And that's why I think that there are a lot of advantages both ways to having Christians in the church who were, so-called raised in the church, that their background is learning about God from an early age, and you can grow and mature quickly that way if you want to. But there's also an advantage to people who have come out of the world, who have had their time to go do worldly things, whether that is in some other distorted form of religion or just in pure worldly living. There's a lot to be gained there from hearing why they moved from worldliness to serving Christ. They realized that it was not all it's cracked up to be. Their story is a good warning to all of us that when we are tempted to leave God and to pursue these things, they can say, don't bother. I've already been there. It really is not all it's cracked up to be. That's basically what Paul's trying to do here. He says, I've walked the Jewish walk, and I don't want to go back to it, even though it would be personally advantageous for me to do so.
Thank you. Now we can see a light spot there for a while, where Paul's dying, you know, he's in Arabia, he's in, doing other things, progressing to learn. Then we see them, I think, pop up in 13, chapter 13, book 14, and how he and Barnabas are together. If we look back through our studies, Paul surrounded himself with a mixture of Jews and Gentiles.
Yes.
And so he had that balance when he went out to teach and send people out. They were educated on both sides.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of interesting to me, because you would think that if God was going to call a specific person to really focus on preaching to the Gentiles, not that Paul never taught the Jews, he certainly did, but a lot more of his time was spent dealing with Gentiles. You know, why Paul? He's not a Gentile. He's not one of them. And sometimes we get maybe too concerned with thinking that we need to be just like our audience, that I need to reach people just like me because that's who I have the most credibility with. And that may or may not be true, but Paul was actually able to use his background to an advantage, that he didn't have the history of idolatrous worship like they did, and so he could come with the fresh perspective of showing them what was better than idols. But then I think God knew that the Judaizers were going to be a thorn in the side of a church for some time. And Paul really stands in a unique position to straddle the line there of, I've had one foot in Judaism for so much of my life, but I've also had another foot in preaching to the Gentiles for so long that I know both worlds really well. And so it's almost like he is mediating between the two. If you read some of his other writings, you know, Romans, for example, he's helping explain that there is no difference between Jew and Gentile anymore, that one is not better than the other. He takes both groups to task. He tells the Jews, you are so proud of yourself that you are sons of Abraham, that you are God's children, and that somehow makes you better. And he says, don't forget that God can raise up children of Abraham from stones if he so chooses, and that this really is irrelevant going forward. But then he also speaks to the Gentiles, and he says, you are so proud of the fact that God chose to graft you in, that you came because the Jews weren't good enough. But don't be so quick to praise yourself there, because if he could graft you in tossing away those who were not faithful, he can just as easily toss you away if you are not faithful and graft somebody else in. So Paul is taking both groups to task and telling them, shape up, listen to God, and obey what he says. That's what you need to do. And I think he had some established credibility with both groups that made him even more capable of doing that. Carmelita? Yeah. Yeah. And Barnabas was very useful in that way. He did a very good thing. It's hard to blame the Christians there in Jerusalem for being afraid of Paul at first. I think any of us would be. If there were somebody in our community who was well known for killing Christians and had killed people in our families, and then one day they walk through the door, and they say, I'd like to join this church. Would you at least raise an eyebrow? I would. I'd want to know if they're sincere. I'd want to know if that's just an attempt to get on the inside here and figure out who we all are and get us all killed. But Barnabas was able to vouch for Paul. Barnabas' word meant something. And so they did accept Paul. So I really think they handled it about the best that they could. I think the temptation there is to want to criticize the Christians in Jerusalem for not accepting Paul immediately, but really they did so very quickly as soon as they had, you know, any reason to believe him. And I think that's a good thing. I think that they showed some wisdom in wanting to know, or I guess wanting to see the fruits of his repentance, but without being needlessly harsh. And sometimes we can do that too, where we want to put somebody on probation for so long that you're not a real member here until I'm satisfied, until a certain amount of time has passed. There are churches that have had that attitude when somebody is baptized or when somebody comes back to the Lord, repents of their sin, that we think, okay, well, they're on thin ice for a while. And that while can go on for a long time sometimes. Much not good. That's a good point. Yeah.
But yeah, when he does come back in, this is a new person, you know, and that what he had to say made sense, because we see there, and for a while, Barnabas happened was a forefront, and as time went by,
right. I don't think Paul was the only one who was persecuting Christians. I don't think the persecution went away completely, but yeah, it had to be a lot easier when he was no longer persecuting them, because he was quite persistent. He was quite zealous. Most people are not that excited about their job and do it with so much vigor. And that made Paul a terrible enemy of the church, but then it also made Paul a great Christian, a great disciple, because he applied that same persistence and diligence into working for the Lord. And it wasn't because he was trying to make up for all the evil that he did. There's a sense in which we never can do that, no matter how much we've sinned. He did it because he knew that his Lord deserved it. Yeah. And I don't know, I mean, Paul very well may have done it with his own hands. We know with Stephen he didn't, but there's nothing saying that he didn't with other Christians. But you're right, even if he never put his hands on anyone, that doesn't make him any less responsible for what he was doing. That's the easy cop-out, saying, I didn't kill anyone, I didn't imprison anyone, I just led the charge and made it easy for others to do it. Even our judicial system, our governmental judicial system, recognizes that that is a crime to aid and abet someone in their crime. A lot of times carries the same sentence or almost the same sentence as the one who actually did it. And so if you tell me that you want to murder a coworker, and I go get you a gun so you can do it, or I drive you so that they can do it, I'm guilty. I have taken an active part in that, even if I didn't pull the trigger myself. And our legal system recognizes that, and it makes good sense to us as well that it would work that way. Jim, why don't you go? Yeah, he held their cloaks. He stood by and approved of what they were doing, and he helped them with what they were doing. Jim? Yes.
He is understanding the truth of why he's here, which made him what he was. So that's how I see it.
Yeah, no, I think you're...
To say he changed, his characteristics didn't change. The man understood differently now, and that's why he
changed. Yeah, Paul's personality really was the same, and for the most part, our personalities stay roughly the same. That's, you know, I am who I am, and I might be able to change habits, and change somewhat of the way I frame the world, but for the most part, I am who I am. Where the shift is where I view my authority, where I ultimately answer to. And for a lot of people, they ultimately answer to themselves. And so I do what I want to do because I want to do it. And that gets you as far as that'll get you, which really isn't all that far. Paul didn't answer to himself, interestingly. He believed he was answering to God, but in reality, he answered to the Jewish leaders. Mike was talking about him getting a letter from Jerusalem authorizing him to go to Damascus and to persecute the Christians there. Well, think about what that is. That he is seeking permission from the religious leaders in Jerusalem for everything that he does. He is acting as their mouthpiece, as their tool. He is doing what they want him to do. He lives to serve the Jewish leaders. And there should be an element of this that we understand because we do this to some degree in our jobs, right? You act as an agent of the company that you work for. If you work for a corporation or even if you work for the government, that you are given instructions to go and do this. You have parameters for how you can do it. You go and it's different than you doing it on a personal level. You do it as an agent of your employer. And for a lot of things, you might need to seek permission if you want to change anything about what you're doing, or make any kind of exceptions or expand the role any, that you answer to somebody else who has the right to tell you, yes, do this, or no, don't do it, or yes, do this, but not that way. I want you to do it this way. And sometimes we roll our eyes because we don't understand the rules that they lay out for us. And we think we could do it better our way, but if you do work for a corporation or anything with a hierarchy, then you realize that you answer to somebody else, at least in some things. I mean, a little general here because everyone's job situation is different, but you know what I'm talking about. Well, Paul was basically looking at it that way. He believed that this was pleasing to God and that he was serving God by what he was doing, but he answered to the Jewish leaders. He got approval from them to go to Damascus. He reported to them and told them everything he was doing. And so what the Judaizers were trying to do is they were pretending like that had not changed. That Paul still answered to the Jews. That was one strategy that they used. And so they were saying, hey, we're on the same team. We're doing the same thing as Paul. You know, we also answer to Jerusalem, and we just have part two of the gospel to bring to you. And so that's the way that they were able to come and preach a different gospel while pretending that it was not a different gospel. It's the same gospel, the same message that Jerusalem wants us to tell you, and Jerusalem rules all. That works until you cut out the faulty premise that Jerusalem is in charge of everything, which it's not. Every religion, or most every religion, has had some home base, has had some seat of power where the rules are decided. For Catholicism, it's the Vatican. It's the Pope. And so what one bishop says or one cardinal says, you know, ultimately goes all the way up to the Pope. And the Pope can issue new decrees. Everyone ultimately reports to him in some way. He is the leader. Other denominations, like we mentioned, have various councils or hierarchies that they use. But I've got some preacher friends, although they call themselves pastors, in denominations. And it always strikes me how different their lives are than mine with their job. Because they talk about getting assigned places that they don't necessarily get to decide where they are going. Like, as a preacher, I can, you know, decide if I'm interested in moving to Del Rio, and if for some reason you want to have me here, then I can, you know, we can decide together that this is a good idea. But some of the pastors that I know in denominations, they're told, hey, you're moving to Topeka, Kansas, and that's the next place that you are going to, you know, lead a church, which is the way that they look at it. And they don't necessarily have a say in that. Some of them do and some of them don't. They all vary. I'm painting with very broad brushstrokes here. But that's very common. Some of them are told the kinds of things they need to preach on. Some of them are actually given a plan that they have to follow on, you're going to preach this week. And the Catholic Church does that. But they have the whole liturgical structure that you know, this is what all of the Catholic churches are going to be preaching on this week. It is one unified message. I don't unify my message with any other preacher in any other church. I just preach on what I've been studying and what needs to be preached on. And so the religious systems in the world come up with that kind of hierarchy where you got to report up the chain. It just works differently in Scripture in that is not such a prominent thing. We read that churches, congregations are given autonomy, that we don't organize ourselves into collectives or into hierarchies of any kind, that we don't have any authority over any other church. There is the provision for eldership, and elders have authority over a church and over the teaching that goes on in that church. But aside from that, there's not really anyone to report to other than God himself. And that's enough. Carmelita? Yeah. Yeah, they really will just sort of rotate people around that If I'm starting to cause problems here, when it's, well, okay, well, we're just going to sweep you away and, you know, take you to a different church and put somebody else here. And it just sort of, you know, minimizing the harm, I guess, or basically trying to sweep the scandal under the rug. And it really reminds me of the way that some corporations work, right? That if you have a problem employee, but you don't want to fire them, and you're the kind of corporation that has multiple locations, I've heard of retail stores doing this, they just transfer them somewhere else in the hopes that maybe they'll get better, or maybe there'll be less of a problem over there, or we can just pretend that we've done something. I've known people who worked in retail stores that have described that phenomenon, and it usually annoys them that happens. And I'm sure it happens in other businesses as well, where people just get shuffled around because we don't want to get rid of them, but they are kind of a problem where they are. So, yeah, I've heard the same thing with the Catholic Church and with others as well, that they kind of rotate priests like that or pastors like that to, you know, sweep scandals under the rug, and that's a very unfortunate thing as well.
And the 16th, 15th chapter, when they have
Yeah, for sure. And we'll have some more to say next week about the interaction between Paul and the other apostles, the relationship that they had, the relationship he had with the other churches in Judea. It's the next part of the mirror reading that we have to do on the arguments that the Judaizers were making. But the big point I want us to get here is that Paul's saying, I wasn't trying to give you some smooth and easy message. It demands sacrifice, and I've shown that in my own life. And I wasn't reporting to Jerusalem, to the council, or to any of the Jewish leaders, because I threw that away. I'm preaching something entirely different now, and they don't approve of what I'm doing, and so don't believe that they did. All right, thanks everyone. Next week, we'll start verses 17 through 24, independent of Jerusalem and the Jerusalem churches. Thank you.